You're listening to The Hour of the Time. I'm Pooh.
And I'm William Cooper.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, sweetheart.
Boy, Sugar Bear keeps barking.
Well, why don't you go see what he's barking at?
All right.
Okay, see you later. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a guest tonight, and I think you're going to be very much enlightened by what he has to say. He has been doing work along the same lines as myself and many others, exposing those who would destroy this country and put us into a one-world socialist totalitarian form of government, and he has written some classic, at least I consider them classic, tracts and booklets and books on the subject. In fact, I have done a couple of broadcasts using some of his material that he has researched and discovered about the NEA, the National Education Association, and I think that many of you were sufficiently shocked by those revelations that that was the motivating factor that got some of you off your derrieres and into the fight, so to speak. I have on the other end of the phone line here Dr. Cuddy. Welcome to the Hour of the Time.
Glad to be with you.
Well, we're certainly happy to have you, and I know that it was a little bit of a sacrifice on your part because you haven't been well lately. But anyway, I'm so happy that you were able to join us for this broadcast. Dr. Cuddy, would you please give us some of your personal background? And by the way, folks, when I say doctor, I mean PhD. What is the subject of your degree?
Yeah, a major would be American history, minor in politics.
Okay. And that, of course, gives you quite a head start on most people, especially if you stuck to the real history and not the social illusion, so to speak. Why don't you tell us your background and how you caught on to what was going on and where it has led you. And let's talk about some of those things.
Well, I've always been rather quizzical and had a tendency to look into matters that were under study. And so many years ago, back in 1963, I went to the first governor's school in the nation, the one that Bill Clinton came in 1979 and modeled his infamous school after. And they were giving us the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Test, and I was always rather curious and found out later that they, the tester had been in correspondence with a psychological corporation, and they wanted to keep files on people like us, the test results, and I looked a little bit, and they had been founded around 1920 by some of these leading educators, the Deweyites. And so a train of study began, I suppose, actually then, although I didn't know it at the time. I went on through the undergraduate degree, taught for a while, went to the public schools, so I found out what a disaster they were becoming. Went back to graduate school, got the graduate degree, and taught for a little while at the university, then went up during, I guess you would say, most of the Reagan years to be a senior associate with the Federal Department of Education. So I got to see the nasty things that were happening in that federal department. And became very, very familiar with the activities of the NEA and others as well, like the Carnegie Foundation. I found there was something of a revolving door there when their people were in power. Like with Clinton now, they would flood into the federal government and NEA people as well. The head of the division I was in is actually run now by an NEA staffer named Sharon Robinson. Deborah DeLee is the executive director of the Democratic National Committee. She's another longtime NEA staffer. So they're very important. When I left there, I became concerned about the broader historical perspective that I had picked up earlier and started tracking these things back to see if there was a plan. Some people have said a historical conspiracy. Where did it come from? Were there several tracks to it? Did it exist today? And that's briefly the story of where I've been.
How did you catch on, Dr. Cuddy, that that it was indeed part of a worldwide conspiracy, and in particular a socialist conspiracy to literally destroy this country and bring about world government?
That, from my historical perspective, I found rather quickly whenever you bring these subjects up, you're branded some kind of right-wing fanatic and you're laughed at. So I found early on that the matter of one's opinion was less important than actually getting things from the horse's mouth, so to speak. So I figured the greatest challenge would be by liberal skeptics. And so what I tried to do was go back to individuals whom they would say they respect and actually find the documentation, the quotations, to demonstrate my point. For example, I would begin a conversation with, suppose I told you that there was a power somewhere so organized, so subtle, so watchful, so interlocked, so complete, so pervasive that you better not speak above your breath when you speak in condemnation of it. Well, after they got finished laughing and having various epithets hurled, I would say, well, I didn't say that. Someone you respect, Democrat, intellectual, president of Princeton University, president of the United States, Woodrow Wilson, said that. Now, their mouth would fall open, and you would have their attention, because not only of what he said, which is extremely important, but they immediately sense that something's wrong with their background, because they're asking themselves, why hasn't some university professor, some media mogul, somebody told me that? And then I would go on with, suppose I told you the government of the United States had been owned ever since the days of Andrew Jackson by a financial element in the larger centers. Again, they'd be skeptical, but they'd be a little wary, and I would immediately tell them, well, I didn't say that. Franklin Roosevelt said that. Now, you have their attention, but they still are skeptical. So their main bugaboo, as it were, is the communist quote. I mean, that's their next line of defense. They say, oh, you sound like some sort of McCarthyite. I said, I'm glad you mentioned that, because Carl Bernstein of Woodward and Bernstein fame, liberal Washington Post person, wrote a book called Loyalty's a Son's Memoirs, and he's talking in the book to his father and mother, who were members of the American Communist Party. And the father is there on the spot, Washington, D.C., and he's saying, look, Carl, I'm concerned about this book you're writing, because all people were saying was that McCarthy was a liar, that he was wrong. And you're actually going to show that McCarthy was right. And McCarthy, Bernstein's father, says, quote, was right. We were a force behind the scenes, a power in the country. And what they had done was they had fooled the press about that. So now you've knocked down another strong point that the skeptics have. And I continue to do that. I go back and find Cecil Rhodes, for example, where he actually specifically says that he has a secret society. People say there's no conspiracy. Well, he says, yes, it's a secret society. I'm going to call it the Society of the Elect, and I track it on up to the present, including the Rhodes scholars like Bill Clinton.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would only disagree with you on one thing there. I don't believe that the press was fooled at all. I believe that a large portion of the press is Marxist, socialist, and a good many of them are even communist. For that reason, they supported the vilification of Joseph McCarthy and succeeded in destroying him. Were you aware, Dr. Cuddy, that just recently the Venona Project, which is the decryption of many of the cables that were sent encoded from the United States to the Soviet Union before and during World War II, have been cracked and decoded, and they prove beyond any shadow of a doubt, no one can argue against this proof, that Joseph McCarthy was not only right, but he had the exact numbers. Because of that, we believe that he must have been fed information from the intelligence community in order to be able to know what he knew at that time, because he wasn't guessing. He had the exact numbers, exact names, and everything.
Right. I think the code name for his was Alice, something like that. And they would not reveal it in trial because they didn't want the Soviets to know that we had cracked the code. Right, that there was a large story in the Washington Post on that, I think.
Yeah, Harry Dexter White and many others. Chambers was, there's no longer any doubt. No one can whitewash these people anymore. They are convicted in their own messages to their puppet masters in the Soviet Union during that time. Recently, we wrote an article, a major headline article in our newspaper, Veritas, about Harry Dexter White and how he gave plates from the United States Treasury to the Soviet Union so that they could print gold notes and United States bills in order to finance what they were doing over there.
Right, and even when they didn't have a specific link in a code name, you'd have people like Harry Hopkins. I think there was a major, his name was Racy, in his diaries would indicate how he was sort of second in command, and Hopkins was funneling through Colorado some nuclear materials over to the Soviets, and was very bold about it. So I'm doing everything I can to help the Soviet Union. Now, this was even before we had the nuclear device, the A-bomb, and he was shuttling that material to them.
Yes. And it's long been known within those who have studied the situation that the secret of the atomic bomb was given to the Soviet Union. They didn't ever steal it. But where has this led you now? Where has this led you, and what are some of the battles that you've had to fight over this?
Well, it's a step-by-step filling in of the puzzle. When I had mentioned the media, for example, and whether they have been hookered or not, of course the top level know what they're doing. Some of the underlings, if you walk, you know, into your local town's television studio, they've been parroting this idea. They're not necessarily communist at the lower levels, but what you find is that many years, even before McCarthy was around, William Paley was starting up, he's a CFR member, and he was starting up Columbia Broadcasting, CBS, and he hired Sigmund Freud's nephew, Edward Bernays, as his chief advisor. And the very year that he hired him, in 1928, Bernays came out with a book called Propaganda, where he said, quote, "Those who manipulate the organized habits and opinions of the masses constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of the country." And he proceeds, I'm not going to read the whole quote, but he says, "We have the technical means, have been invented and developed, whereby we can regiment your opinion." He's very bold. These people are, you know, very outspoken about this.
Yes.
So it's been a matter of convincing individuals, in the words of people who are directly involved, of what's happening. For example, when you say the CFR, they start to roll their eyes and say, "Oh, here we go again, the CFR right-wing conspiracy." And I say, look, Bill Clinton's the president. You probably have voted for him. I'm talking to these skeptics now. And they'll say, "Oh, sure, he's doing wonderful things, and he's not a socialist." Not a socialist. Okay, I understand what you're saying. And I just go back, and I track where Rhodes set up the society. I said, look, he formed the round table groups. Carol Quigley was his mentor at Georgetown University, and he wrote Tragedy and Hope. And in this book, Quigley is saying how he looked at the, quote, secret records, quote, of the power elite, and they formed what were called roundtable groups. These are semi-secret groups, his association of helpers, after Rhodes died. That, Quigley says, formed later the Royal Institute Against National Affairs in England, and he says the CFR was the branch in this country.
Yes.
Around 1919. Now, there was another part to this, but they'll immediately say, oh, well, that's Quigley. I say, no. Arthur Schlesinger, leading historian, Kennedy administration advisor, look at his book, A Thousand Days, where he says that the CFR is a, quote, front organization, quote, for the power elite. Quigley says the same thing, quote, front, quote, group. Both of these people are using the same term. Walter Isaacson, senior editor, Rhodes Scholar, Time magazine, he's quoting Schlesinger, saying the same thing, that the wise men, he called them, were a front people. And they'll say, well, who? Name names. I want names. And so you proceed along that line and say, okay, in this book, the Institute for Advanced Study was the branch, like All Souls College over in England, in this country. This is according to Quigley.
You know, it sounds like you're reading my book, almost verbatim.
Abraham Flexner is at the nexus of this thing. Now, Flexner was a key because back at Johns Hopkins, he got out of there in 1886. This was right after G. Stanley Hall had come to Johns Hopkins. Hall had been the first graduate student, PhD, of Wilhelm Wundt at the Leipzig School over in Germany. And Wundt's great-grandfather was codenamed Raphael with the Illuminati.
Mm-hmm.
When he gets over here, Daniel Court Gilman, Skull and Bones, is president of Johns Hopkins. Flexner is at the nexus because he's part of what was called an educational trust in 1915. This is a group of leaders who said, we're going to take over education, get our people in key positions. One of them was George Strayer, who would become head of the NEA and say, give them the axe if they don't do what we say. Flexner was also with the Carnegie Foundation, which is a key, and then he went with the Rockefeller General Education Board in 1912. A little bit later, a Judge Hyland found a note about a secret meeting, and he would use it, Hyland would, to run for mayor, to become mayor. And he said, look, I found this secret meeting was going on where Flexner and the rest of you were trying to get a certain individual named Wirt to become head of the Board of Education of New York and institute an outcome-based education school-to-work initiative. And when he became mayor, Hyland said, I'm getting rid of the Rockefeller agents in education because you're training these youngsters for the mill and the factory just like Chinese coolies. And what they had done was, when you mentioned socialism, the plan was along that line in the sense that Stalin, even before the Russian Revolution in 1917, in 1913, he was given a speech in Vienna in January, and he said, I'm having trouble getting my Marxist cadres into place. So what I'm going to do is I'm developing a strategy of regionalism. That way, I can break down loyalties, national patriotism, by funneling people's attentions toward regional arrangements, let's say like a NAFTA.
Mm-hmm.
That way, I can have my class struggles, you know, the corporate elite against the masses of workers, and I can have use the slogan, workers of the world unite, and so forth. So what you have then is a key person at the nexus here. You find that the roundtable groups, these are the semi-secret groups that Rhodes, after he's died, has in place to get key people into the fields of journalism, education, economics, and politics. Up to 1963, the roundtable groups are led by Lord Brand, Robert Brand. And that's important because he's managing director of Lazard Brothers, big banking, international banking house. After 63, same thing. Adam Maris is managing director of Lazard Brothers and heads the roundtable groups. Now, that's important because today, Bill Clinton tried to get Felix Rohatyn onto the Federal Reserve Board. And Rohatyn is the key figure with Lazard Brothers. And when he was testifying before Senator Ernest Hollings, Commerce Committee, about GATT, he actually came out and made something of a veiled threat. He said, look, the international financial community has already anticipated you're going to pass GATT. And if you don't, there are going to be dire international consequences to that. The way that fits with the Rhodes scholars is Richard Gardner, whom Clinton appointed as our ambassador to Spain, was a Rhodes scholar. In 1974, Gardner is the one who wrote in Foreign Affairs that they're going to get to the House of World Order by eroding national sovereignty piece by piece. And then he goes on to explain how they use GATT to do it. After that, Strobe Talbott is another appointee, Bill Clinton's roommate at Oxford University. He wrote in Time magazine, perhaps national sovereignty was not such a great idea after all, and the case for world government is clinched. After he wrote that, Clinton wrote a letter to the World Federalist Association. I have a copy of the letter with Clinton's signature. Clinton is congratulating the WFA for giving Strobe Talbott one of their Norman Cousins Global Governance Awards for that specific article. And in the letter, Clinton specifically says, your past president, Norman Cousins, worked for, quote, world government, quote, and Clinton concludes the letter by wishing the WFA, quote, future success, quote. Now, another Rhodes Scholar, there's many, we won't go into all of them, but one is Ira Magaziner, who was behind Hillary with her health plan and her certificate of initial mastery, and Robert Reich. Reich wrote, just before Clinton became president, he wrote the book called The Work of Nations. And in there, Reich is saying, quote, there will be no national products or technologies, no national corporations, no national industries. There will no longer be national economies. And he goes on to explain how we're just going to have these skillful workers and the other less skilled be consigned to a declining standard of living. And that's the problem we'll have to face. Other people, not just, like I said, that's only one strand. The Skull and Bones is another strand where you'd have Winston Lord appointed to a high-level position in the Clinton administration. Just as Clinton is becoming president, he delivers a speech on September 29th of 1992 saying that, to a certain extent, we're going to have to yield some of our sovereignty, which will be controversial at home. Under NAFTA, some Americans are going to be hurt as low-wage jobs are taken away. So there's this series of individuals like that within the administration, or they may be outside, like Walter Wriston, who wrote, he was head of Citicorp, and he wrote a book called The Twilight of Sovereignty, where he says it's going to be gone. That's just the way it's going to be. And so what you have is inside the administration, outside the administration, key individuals. Now, when you raise the question of socialism, the way that fits in as to what they're hitting us towards is sort of a synthesis. They see a synthesis of Western capitalism and Eastern communism into a world-wide socialism.
Mm-hmm. That's the justification, is a compromise so that it will prevent wars over these ideals. But that's it's really part of an old plan, which goes along the idea of the Hegelian dialectic, which is that everything in life that is opposing leads to a conflict, which creates then, in its outcome, a synthesis, which ultimately ends up with less and less opposing ideologies, and ultimately will end up with just two, which will then have a conflict and come up with the ideal method of ruling and dealing with people and economies and governments and things like that.
Absolutely. That's exactly right. The plan was for many, many years was to create such a synthesis. I'm going to divert just for a minute because what you raised is sort of the economic background. What they were trying to do in an economic sense was created by a certain debt procedure, whether it's the 1907 panic, which led to bank closings and inflation and unemployment, so people would say, oh, my goodness, we need to manage the economy, give us the Federal Reserve, or, the same sort of thing in 1929 with the Great Depression and so forth. They would deliberately do this sort of thing. There's been plenty of testimony by congressmen like McFadden, saying how our money would go on the one hand to the Nazis in 32, and in the 33 would give from the Federal Reserve a tremendous amount to the Soviets on the other side. Both sides would get it.
Mm-hmm.
And McAdoo, who was Wilson's treasurer, would say the same thing. He said, I fear that there are many men in high places and we're just going to become a puppet government. And then it branches out into the Bank for International Settlements today. So, I mean, it's even so blatant that you have quotations visuals at the New York Times. There was an article in August of last year by a fellow named Bradshaw saying these people with a stroke of a pen can alter alter the economies of the world. But anyway, back to the socialism. Stroke Talbot's brother-in-law is Derek Shearer. And Shearer had done a couple of books some years ago. In 1980, one of them, he's a friend and advisor of Clinton. Clinton was going to give him a high-level position, but when some senators got wind of his connection with the Institute for Policy Studies, they nixed that. But anyway, Shearer had written Economic Democracy, promoting socialistic ideas like national health care and insurance. And in there, he talked about a vision and change and so on in 1980. And he said, what we got to do is we won't call it socialism, but we'll say economic democracy. We'll get this Democrat to run on our principles and he'll institute what we want. A few years later, he revised that to what's called the New Social Contract, where he talked that we need the collective good, you know, that sort of term. And then he said, quote, whether this is labeled a step toward democratic socialism, we leave for the theorists. In other words, it'd be socialism, you know, we just won't call it that. And Shearer was not alone in this push. You had both Bill and the other co-president, Hillary, involved in this. And Hillary's guru, so to speak, was Michael Lerner, who edits Chacoon magazine. And back in the 70s, Lerner wrote a book called The New Socialist Revolution. I mean, that was the title of the book. And he said, we're going to use education, we'll manipulate it into training skilled workers and so forth, and we'll just have socialism. Hillary was writing an article in the Harvard Educational Review the same year talking about how children were not just the parents' responsibility, but the broader society. Government really has a role. And the way that all fits is Hillary Clinton was on the board of something called the National Center for Education and the Economy. And this goes back to my own personal background. Just as I was coming into the federal government, someone named Mark Tucker, a Carnegie person, was leaving the exact division that I was in the Department of Education. Tucker went to head up this National Center on Education and the Economy. Well, right after Bill Clinton wins, Tucker writes a letter to Hillary Clinton, and he says, I've just come out of David Rockefeller's office, and Rockefeller's also on their board, and he says, we are, quote, celebrating, quote, Bill Clinton's victory because it's going to give us a chance to put into place our human resource management system from cradle to grave for everybody, one system. And so what they do is they push this sort of school to work. This is a big controversy today in Congress, which is a combination of the old Soviet polytechnical system and the German apprenticeship system. Heading towards, in terms of what you just said about a synthesis, I guess we call it a techno-feudal, F-E-U-D-A-L society, where it would be like the old feudal society with the elite at the top, similar later to the French Revolution, where you have these philosopher kings and these peasants underneath. But it would be a techno-feudal society where you have these highly trained elite individuals who are very much versed in computers and so on. And then the masses of largely unskilled or service industry types of people. These were actually predicted in several books. One was called The Lord of the World by Robert Benson. And
I wrote exactly the same thing in my book, that America, in fact, would become a service society to the rest of the world.
That's right. And Benson's, when Benson did that in 1907, he predicted that... Now, remember, this is 1907,
right.
And he says in 10 years, communism will come to the fore in 1917. Then he said in 1989, there would be Western free trade as the scheme to bring it into place. Then he said in 1998, there'd be ministers of euthanasia to get rid of the people they don't want, so on. But even before him, Jack London had written a book called The Iron Heel in 1907, same year. And this book is where Orwell got the phrase, a boot stamping on a human face forever, in his book 1984. And London said the actual text that the oligarchs and the plutocrats were used would be Our Benevolent Feudalism by a fellow named W.J. Gent, G-A-T-N-T, in around 1902. And Gent laid it all out, but the quotes are too long, I don't want to read them. But he specifically said what you were just saying is happening today. And he says, this is the plan. This is how they're going to do it. This is the way they're going to do it. He spelled it all out. Now, the reason I also bring up Kent is There's what's called the H.G. Wells Archives in this country, and it's in Champaign-Urbana at the university there. And you can actually get the letters going back and forth between Wells and Churchill and Rudyard Kipling and Gent and all of these people, Bernard Shaw. In fact, I got one letter where Churchill is writing to Wells. Wells has been talking to him, and he says, look, I can't talk about this outside the secret circle. I mean, he puts that, you know, in this letter.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get these letters, the private documents and papers of these individuals, and Gent is writing to Wells saying, look, I'm sending this woman over there. She's interested in socialism, the Fabian style, and he signs it, your revolutionary comrade. Now, the reason that's very, very important, and the way I try to track these down, unlike some others, so for example, Pat Roberts' book, The World Order, doesn't even mention the Fabians, doesn't even mention Wells.
It wasn't even written by Pat Roberts.
Well, yeah, that's another story. But in that, you would think that a person who probably wrote the... But the point of it is Wells, writing the Time Machine and all these things people know about, he was very much one of the early Fabians and a planner. He had written a book called Anticipations back in 1901, I think it was, where he said, look, we're going to call this the New Republic. And that's where the magazine, The New Republic, got its name. And he says, in the end, these people will have a cause worth killing for. We won't be squeamish about it. We'll just kill, you know, if you get in the way. And then he revised, another version came out in 1908, New World for Old, where he said, we will implement socialism, the people won't know it. He said, they won't have any resistance, they won't know it. We'll get our key people in place, in the bureaucracy, presidents, they'll come and go, prime ministers come and go, but we'll have our key people through regulations to implement socialism as we want it. He revised it a little bit in 1928 into a book called The Open Conspiracy, Blueprints for World Revolution, and where he said it may be in control of Moscow before New York, and they'd use education and so forth and so on. Then he revised that in 1933 into a book called The Shape of Things to Come, where he said there'll be a Second World War. It'll begin around 1939 over a German-Polish dispute. Then in our third try, in about 40 years or so, we'll succeed with our plan for world government, and it'll come out of something at Basra, Iraq, and later they call it the New World Order, and he mapped out exactly how it would happen, like you said, a synthesis between Western capitalism and Eastern communism, and then he did his final revision of that in 1939 in a book called The New World Order. And where he spelled out exactly what the synthesis would be like. In the prior book, The Shape of Things to Come, he said it would be endlessly feared and murmured against, but in the end, there'd be no effective opposition prepared against us because we'd use this synthesis. Now, you would think that somewhere along the line, Pat Robertson or whoever it is would just stumble across that. I don't know if there's any connection, but I do know that the Fabian Socialists established the London School of Economics in 1895 to get this thing rolling, and I know Pat does make a big deal about he went to the London School of Economics.
Yes. If you listen to him very carefully, you'll find that he is really calling for worldwide Christianity to unite under one leader. And if you watch very carefully, you'll see the ecumenism of what he is teaching is to actually blend all of the different denominations and beliefs into one. Hold your thoughts now. We've got to take a short break, and we'll be right back in just a second. Everybody, listen to this very carefully, because what we're talking about here is an indoctrination that is so subtle that most of the time you don't even understand that it's happening. And many of the tools that are used to bring you under the socialist yoke are things that you think you like because you're not really paying attention. Listen very carefully.
No hell.
If you listen to those words, ladies and gentlemen, you know that many, many people who are Marxist socialists today got their first inclination that they were going to go along that road when John Lennon sang that song. If you don't believe me, you trace the inspiration back with people you know, and you will find that things like this create a lot of problems for those of us who are ruled by our head and not by social illusion. Now, if you think what Dr. Cuddy and I are talking about tonight is out of sight, over the hill, gone, not worth worrying about, I'm holding in my hands the May-June 1996 edition of Foreign Affairs. This is the official publication of the Council on Foreign Relations. And the lead article, as I've been telling you all along, this cinches it, because whatever is printed in here always comes to pass within 2 years. Everything that is ever printed in Foreign Affairs comes to pass within 2 years. They wait until they're within 2 years of their goal, and they signal to all of the people who are doing the work, the thousand points of light, if you will, exactly what's going to be done over the next 2 years. And here's what it says. Workers and the world economy. Quote, the world may be moving inexorably toward one of those tragic moments that will lead historians to ask, why was nothing done in time, end quote. And on the cover page of the article, the global economy is leaving millions of workers in its train. Workers in the world economy, dealing with a Russia in turmoil, Ukraine, Europe's linchpin, China after Ding. And then, for those of you who say there's no new world order, the next three words are new world order. The myth of post-Cold War chaos, reviving the West and globalizing free trade. In this article is a chilling prediction of the collapse of middle-class America. And you had better take it to heart. Call Swiss America Trading, get yourself some real money, protect at least a part of your assets, and prepare yourself. If you don't adequately prepare, you are going to be one of the people who find yourselves living in a ditch. 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. Do it now, folks. You'll be glad that you did. Many of you are already glad that you did, because you've made quite a bit of money since I started telling you to do this about 4 years ago. By the way, our fourth anniversary is coming up just within the next few days, ladies and gentlemen. Let's get back to Dr. Cuddy. His message is an important one. Right now, I want to talk about your book, Dr. Cuddy. Tell us about the books that you have to offer, because I know that people just from listening to you talk off the top of your head tonight are going to want to get their hands on those books. I can tell you from my own experience reading the work and the research of Dr. Cuddy, it is an extraordinary compilation of material and knowledge that you're going to have trouble getting your hands on anywhere else.
Well, I appreciate that opportunity. I'll just give three numbers, if I could. The first one is for the Plymouth Rock Foundation, and they published two little booklets. One's called Secret Records Revealed, that has to do with the Rhodes Scholars and Bill Clinton. And the other one you mentioned, The Grab for Power, about the NEA, and that's 1-800-210-1620. The second number is for Hearthstone, like the hearth in your home.
Dr. Cuddy, I hate to interrupt, but you need to repeat each number slowly twice.
Okay, we'll go back to the Plymouth Rock Foundation. That's 1-800-210-1620. 1-6.
Dr. Cuddy, hold on. We just lost the satellite. I'm going to try to get back up. When we're talking about important subjects, we get knocked off. Hold on. When did it go off? Oh, don't you tell me that. Well, folks, we were knocked off the air. I don't know why, but we're back on now. And Dr. Cuddy, you were talking about your books and how people can get their hands on those books. Would you continue with that, please? Why don't you just start over again?
Okay. The first number is 1-800-210-1620. I'll repeat that. 1-800-210-1620. That's the Plymouth Rock Foundation, and they have my booklets. One is Secret Records Revealed, about the Rhodes Scholars and Bill Clinton, and the other one is The Grab for Power, about the NEA. The second phone number is 1-800-652-1144. Again, 1-800-652-1144. That's Hearthstone, like the hearth in your home. And they have my books and booklets on the New Age, New World Order, and Bill Clinton and the New World Order. And the last number is 941-644-6218. I'll repeat it, 941-644-6218. That's for Pro Family Forum. And they have my two items. One's The Road to Socialism and the New World Order. And they also have a 200-year education chronology that I track over those 200 years how we got in the mess we're in.
I found that particularly invaluable in helping us in our research in the destruction of our educational system here. And I highly recommend it for anybody who wants to know what's happening to your children and why.
It's especially good for people because it has a 3,000-item index at the back of it. So any subject, sex ed, death ed, whatever, you just look in the index and there it is. I'd like to, if I could, pick up on what you just played, the song Imagine by Lennon, because it,
please do.
That's critical in this sense. The Beatles were picking up on I guess you call it a strategy of Theodore Adorno, which would be a sort of a fractious music can shake up the society. And Adorno had followed a person called Antonio Gramsci, who said you don't just attack a country like with a revolution and arms. You undermine the culture and you thereby change the consciousness in all phases, religion, everything. And so what happened was, I mentioned the Psychological Corporation. About the time they were beginning, something called Tavistock, was the psychiatric clinic was beginning over in England. Later on, the NEA and Tavistock got together with a research group on group dynamics, actually, by Kurt Lewin in the 40s. And they set up the National Training Laboratories, as it was called, and they developed later sensitivity training, which one of their own documents in 1962 calls, quote, brainwashing. And what they would do, in music, they would create a sort of fractionalization of the society, and you would find people like leaders of The Who and the Jefferson Airplane saying, yes, we're trying to create a generation gap. We want to separate people for this revolution, which we're creating. In the National Training Labs, they call it unfreezing, changing, and refreezing of values.
And they made no secret of the fact that they were engaged in fomenting revolution. They spoke of it often, all of these bands and rock and roll figures. And I have to admit that when I was a young man, I found myself easily influenced by some of these things.
Yeah, it broadened out beyond the music because, like Gramsci said, you have to have a total societal approach. And so what you would find is individuals like Saul Alinsky, who Hillary Clinton picked up on at Park Ridge Methodist Church when she was in Chicago as a young woman. Alinsky would write a book called Rules for Radicals in the early 70s, and he had an acknowledgement to Lucifer in the front of it. He said you have to rub raw the sentiments of the community. You know, you have to shake things up. About the same time, the U.S. Department of Education, it wasn't called that, it was HEW at the time, was funding a project that resulted in a book called Training for Change Agents, where they said the same thing, that you have to shake up the values of the community, get people off balance, and then I think like the next year, the spring of 74, there was $5.9 million was appropriated by Congress to train 500 change agents to go out, you know, into the schools and the community.
Mm-hmm.
And what you found was the creation of this sort of me generation, you know, what's in it for me, isolated individuals. That would be, you'd break the link between generations and respect and love and so forth towards these individuals who then could be remolded. I think Sidney Hook, one of the leading humanists, said, we'll get them by indirection. It won't be a frontal assault. It'll be an indirect run. And then I believe one of the founders of the 4 million member International Humanist and Ethical Union, his name was H.J. Blackham. He said if schools teach dependence on oneself, like an autonomous moral decision maker, quote, they are more revolutionary than any conspiracy to overthrow the government, end quote. And that's what their tactic was. Because you would come into a school and you'd say you're very bright, you need to be in advanced class, you're an autonomous moral decision maker, and so forth, and they would create a division between what the parents were trying to teach at home and then these youngsters were trying to teach, to learn. And they would combine that with the mantra, quote, don't impose your morality on me, that the pro-abortionists use. And you link those two together, and there's no doubt as to why there's this crime increase in juveniles today. I literally expect one of them to come up before a judge and say, I've been taught that the government shouldn't impose any particular morality on me, so I shoplifted. So what? You know, what's in it for me? I'm an autonomous moral decision maker.
It was a learning experience.
That's right. I was acting on it. In fact, that's one of their codes. You know, you must act on the principle. You must shake through the 7 points of values clarification. Louis Rath actually came up with that term, and way back they had an 8-year study, and Ralph Tyler, who was another Carnegie person, and Hilda Tamba, the Estonian change agent, all got together and, you know, developed this sort of thing, and Sidney Simon would get on it, and later they call it values clarification of schools, situation ethics, and they wiped out God. You can't pray to God, but yet they're ramming this philosophy down these kids' throats now. And this is part of the whole Graham-Adorno fracture of the society, create the generation gap, unfreeze the values, change them, refreeze them into the sort of new age, they would call it today, movement. And it's all part of the synthesis towards a world government. It's not just government, like Barry Goldwater said, and with no apologies. He says what they want, he's talking about trilaterals. He says it's not just social, political, economic control. They want ecclesiastical control as well.
Yes.
Have to have a one-world religion, you know, where you worship Mother Gaia, the earth, instead of God.
And yes, that's true. You know, this is incredible. I'm going to ask you a question point blank here. And I want you to give me an honest answer because there's so many people out there who want to know the answer to this. I know the answer because I've been studying this for many, many years. And the answer will surprise many people. Is this a Jewish conspiracy?
No. And what I tell people when they say, is it a Jewish conspiracy? I said, look, I'm sure there are Jews, so-called Christians, Buddhists, and whatnot. You would have to have that in any massive worldwide plan.
Yes.
But when the names like Rockefeller come up, he wasn't. J.P. Morgan wasn't. Andrew Carnegie wasn't. You say, but it's the Rothschilds, isn't it? I say, okay, well, who are the Rothschilds? They're primarily associated with the Bank of England. Where did the Bank of England get its money from? They got their money primarily from people with a House of Orange in the prior to the establishment of the Bank of Amsterdam in the 1600s, and they would be what you would call today, quote, liberal humanist. I mean, it's not the same, but it's basically the same. That's where their money comes from. So is this a liberal Protestant conspiracy? No. Before them were the Knights Templar, who were sort of renegade Catholics. Does that mean it's a renegade Catholic conspiracy? No. You can go back and back and back with this thing.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, we've traced the thread of this all the way back to the dawn of the history of man.
Sure.
When certain people learned that hoarding knowledge
and using that to control other people and creating religions with two basic dogmas or messages, really, one esoteric and one exoteric, that they could rule those peoples. And it's been carried on to this present day through secret societies and organizations and literary guilds and you name it, but specifically in the brotherhoods and the fraternal organizations and the secret societies, it has just thrived. But today it's not really a conspiracy in secret. It's all out in the open. They are so arrogant and so convinced of their invincibility that nothing is hidden today.
No, that was part of the plan. It's sort of like Rhodes' conspiracy was to develop a system to get key people in place so they wouldn't have to have a conspiracy down the road. Same thing with Alice Bailey and her works. She used the term many, many years ago. She was a leading occultist in the first half of the century. She would specifically over and over again talk about points of light connected to service in a, quote, new world order. Now, where have we heard that recently? This goes way, way back. Alexander Hamilton and George Washington wrote in those terms. Alexander was trying to, I got a letter, he's trying to persuade Washington to run for the presidency, and he's saying the point of light in which I see you, so forth and so on, and Washington writes back to him, yes, the point of light and so which I see myself and blah, blah, blah. And it goes back to Skull and Bones, that whole track back through the Aryan races and so on. In fact, I think they found some swastikas in the vault there at Yale where they were.
Well, the swastika is an old symbol for the worship of the sun,
sure.
Which is the representation, actually, of Lucifer, the intellect, the light. The fire that was thrown to earth, which was given as a gift to man by Prometheus, and through the use of fire, they've developed knowledge and intellect and industry, and with the use of that, man himself shall become God.
Right.
That's the whole thread of the. I've been teaching that for years to people who will listen to try to help them understand who and what their enemy is and why. Without trying to tell them, you know, what they themselves should believe, but everybody's got to understand that you cannot ignore the religious structure and the belief structure and the philosophy of those who are trying to destroy us.
Right. And what's interesting is now people even on the left seem to be catching on. There's a fellow who writes for The Nation, a sort of leftist magazine. He's nationally syndicated, Alexander Cockburn. And he recently wrote, quote, there is an emerging outline of world government composed of international monetary funds, central banks, the leading industrial nations. National sovereignty is being eroded, most recently by the GATT Treaty. Liberties are under threat, as now displayed by Clinton's anti-terrorism package. Politics in America are so decayed, so rotted out, that the surprise is not that there are patriot militias, but that there are not more of them, end quote. Now, that's a leftist writing that. And when you get on the inside, I mean, not your opinion, my opinion, or some official, but individuals like, there's one, Terry Gellinoy, who wrote Charge It, Inside the Credit Card Conspiracy. Now, this fellow is former director of communications at the National Bank Americard, late of Visa, a very respected person. And in there, he said, quote, George Orwell's notorious character, Big Brother, will actually turn out to be Big Banker, all-seeing, all-knowing, all-controlling, capable of destroying any resistance. Where they're taking you is to a totally different kind of economic society in which you will have little or no privacy, in which your income and everything you own will be under their control. You will be a profitable, dependable, fiscally sound, paid-up citizen, even if they have to destroy your freedom and even your life to do it, end quote.
Yes.
On the inside.
It'll be an economic system of cashless debt chained to a computer in an economic slavery for life.
And the mark of the beast.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Wow. Well, this is incredible, and I knew it was going to be a memorable, wonderful broadcast that would certainly open people's eyes and lead them on the road to educating and awakening. But I tell you the truth, did not quite anticipate that it would be so good. Now, we talked about possibly doing two nights. How do you feel?
I think I better rest my throat. I don't know if it's up to another. I had throat surgery, so I think I better rest it.
Well, that's why I'm asking you, because I knew that. You sound much better tonight than when we spoke on the phone and arranged for this broadcast. But we certainly don't want to push you into injuring yourself again. I would like to have you back on this on the hour of the time at some date in the near future. And you have my phone number. I hope when you feel a little better, you'll call me and we can get you back on here. Folks, if you'd like to get some of Dr. Cuddy's books, I highly recommend them. And I don't get a penny from any of these books. I want you to get them because they will help open your eyes, help lead you to an awakening that might possibly help us save our freedom. 800-210-1620. That's 800-210-1620. Ask about Dr. Cuddy's books. I'm just going to give you the numbers because there's not time to give you anything else. 800-652-1144. That's 800-652-1144. And the last one, 941-644-6218. That's 941-644-6218. And you know it's a memorable broadcast, and we've talked about something that hurts them to the quick when they dump us off the satellite. Thank you, Dr. Cuddy.
Thank you.
And good night, folks. God bless you all.
The girl on the half shell could keep you unharmed.